Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So many white guys.
So many.
So many white guys. So what?
How much whiteness? All over the place. God damn. So many white guys. So many white guys.
Welcome to So Many White Guys from WNYC Studios. I'm your host, Phoebe Robinson.
And I'm Joanna Solitaroff.
All right. Here's the tea. Here's the Lipton tea, honey bunnies. I know we said our last episode was the final episode of the season, but we've got some cray-cray banay-nay news. Joni?
Yeah, after the Chris Hayes interview dropped, we got a ton of email from white guys who wanted to be on the show. It was crazy. Like, the phone was ringing off the hook. The fan mail was pouring in. I was getting faxes for the first time, which is so weird because I didn't even know I had a fax machine, but it turns out that I do. Thank you, WNYC.
And so does Mel Brooks, apparently. He's all about that fax, baby.
Fax life.
Hashtag fax life. But for real, we got some calls from some pretty legendary white guys. I mean, so many Williams. We got a voicemail from William Shatner. We got an email from William Shakespeare. We got a dozen roses from William Defoe.
Oh, it's actually Willem.
The point is, there were so many white guys. They all wanted a piece of my fine chocolate ass, and they wanted a piece of your fine vanilla ass, Joni.
Oh, jeez.
That was your...
I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, I'll take the compliment, but moving on...
Mm-hmm.
We always say we have one token white guy, but then we got an email from the ultimate white guy.
Yeah.
Numero uno of white guy. The king hombre of white guys.
You guys, hold on to literally your fucking 401ks and your fucking topsider shoes. We got Tom motherfucking Hanks.
Tom Hanks.
Holy shit. I'm a grown-up, but I'm actually a kid playing a giant piano. Tom motherfucking Hanks.
Tom, I live on an island and talk to a volleyball, Hanks.
Oh, my God. Wilson. Oh, fucking
fuck. His face might be made out of blood, but you still feel for the guy.
Oh, my God. Wilson was, like, so intense. You guys, if you haven't seen Castaway yet, what the fuck is wrong with you? It's been 20 years. Sorry, that was aggressive.
No, that was a good side note, though. That was your op-ed. Phoebe Robinson op-ed. That's going to be in the New Yorker for sure.
Here's the thing. When T. Hanks says he wants to talk to you, you don't go, I'm sorry, I have a token white guy. Maybe season 3?
No,
you don't say that. You get... right up on it. I couldn't pass it up. We had to do that interview, baby.
What's that saying? Nobody says no. Isn't there like a saying, like a catchphrase, like, oh, nobody puts baby in a corner. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody puts Tom Hanks in a corner either.
Oh, no, you respect Tom Hanks, okay? He's won 2 freaking Oscars. Respect that. All right, let's get to the commercial break because on the other side of this is my conversation with the whitest man in America, literally the best man in America, Tom Hanks!
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to So Many White Guys. Joanna, I want to get right into this interview. Tom Hanks needs no introduction.
Yeah, I didn't even bother to write one.
Okay.
He doesn't need it.
Classy, Joanna. Really classy. Okay, let me begin again. Hey, boo-boos. My guest today needs no introduction. LOL. Maybe you've heard of his name before. It's Tom freaking Hanks. Yeah, that Tom Hanks.
Wait, which Tom Hanks?
I'm talking about Big, Splash, Turner and Hooch, Sleepless in Motherfucking Seattle, The Money Pit, Saving Private Paul Ryan, Forrest, Your Goofball Gump, Sully, I Saved Your Freaking Lives, Sullenberg, Castaway, The Man Was Trapped on a Fucking Island for Your Entertainment, and then he was trapped in a fucking airport in The Terminal, Joe Versus the Volcano, The Green Mile, A League of Their Own, Apollo 13,
Yep.
Toy Story.
Got
quite a career. Toy Story Dos.
Are you gonna say three?
Toy Story Tres. Thieves. The Da Vinci Code.
Thieves, I think we can get to it.
Polar Express.
Thieves.
My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2.
This intro's gonna be half an hour long.
Schindler's List.
He's not in Schindler's List.
Whew. Sorry, I just got, when I get on a roll talking about the one and only Tom Hanks, I get lit.
Yeah, fucking, but he wasn't in Schindler's
okay,
List.
Okay, he was in Bosom Buddies with Peter Scolari. He was in that.
Yeah, that's just like Schindler's List. Great there, comparison.
Okay, thank you.
Good job.
You know what? You're fired. Everyone involved in this show is fired. I could do this all by myself. I know what sound design is. I know what editing is. I know what social media is.
You've got mail.
We cut to an interview with Tom Hanks where it just sounds like he's talking to the teacher from Snoopy. Yeah, we just replaced you with that after you, like, burn us all.
Okay, obviously I need all of you because my talent is talking and not, like, actual skills. The point is, T. Hanks has an amazing resume, a big resume.
Ew. Why'd you say that sexually?
What?
Oh, never mind. Did you also know that he's got a book of short stories coming out?
Mm-hmm.
And did you know that he's performed on Broadway?
Yep.
He's got 2 Academy Awards for Best Actor.
I mean, what can't that man do?
Let's find out.
Thank you so much for doing my show, So Many White Guys.
Yeah,
you
sure.
are the quintessential white guy.
I am that. Yeah. Yes, you are. You are correct there. I'm about as white as I get. I'm that white guy that when you say, hey, what do you have on your playlist? I say, whoa. Well, let me tell you, Phoebe. Oh, I've got a big variety of artists on my playlist. I've got, how about a little John Coltrane?
Ooh.
Are you impressed with that?
Yes.
Not bad. How about a little Funkadelic? That's not bad.
That's good. Do you have some Tom Petty, some Neil Diamond? Tell me the truth.
I have all the quintessential white guys on
yeah.
there as well.
What made you say yes to doing this show? Do you even know what this show is?
I have no idea. the name of the podcast made me laugh so much that I said, yeah, I'll do that.
Oh,
I'll do a podcast name that. I'm game.
I'm so happy you're doing this. And like the thing I told one of my friends who's black, and one of the things that I love about black people is like they get so excited. So when I was like, I'm really nervous to say anything because I don't want to jinx it. I believe very much in jinxing. But I was like, I'm going to interview Tom Hanks. And she was like, what? You're going to talk to Sully? Like, it's so funny. Like black people will literally refer to white people as like the last thing they saw them in. So you're just like Sully to her. She's like, you're talking to Sully? That's cool.
This is music to my ears because, you know, usually the way the show business cottage industry works is they only talk about the hits that you had 15 years ago. You know, it's like, you know, you could have a brand new record out. You know,
yeah.
you could be the Beatles. You could have a brand new record out and it's a fabulous record and you're really proud of it. And you want to, and they all just come back to when you recorded Please, Please Me in 1961. Do you know you had a hit? So I love that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'll take that.
So I did a bunch of research for this. This was like,
all right,
this is the huge, huge one. So I got some hard hitting questions coming your way.
Hit 'em.
So let's just start it out.
On.
Okay. So my first question is, how does it feel to have only ever played white men?
No, I know. It's a burden. I keep trying to break out. I keep trying to come off with, some aspect of more heredity to it. All the guys that played are very white, but occasionally I assemble those chromosome tests for them, you know, the DNA tests. Mm-hmm. And I played characters with like 35% of Spanish Moor DNA, you know, maybe came to Spain through Algeria. I play guys, and they have 17% Brazilian blood inside them. If anybody asked me, you know, what are you? What are you? I say, oh, I'm half Portuguese, a Swarthy.
Wait, are you really?
I am half Portuguese, and that is officially, I believe.
Wow!
If you go to Portugal, there's a substantial amount of Portuguese people that are Swarthy, and brown skin, particularly at the end of summer. So I do play a lot of white guys, but I'm a multi-hued blood, and it's not all red. Some of it's brown.
When did you find out that you're Portuguese?
One day my mom sat me down when I was old enough to understand and said, son, I need you to know something. You never met them, but your grandparents are both from the old country. I don't know if she was the first generation. She might have been the second generation. But she grew up in the California Valley, the agricultural valley. Mm-hmm. And I've been told that back in the day, a long time ago, the Portuguese were sort of like the migrant farmers. And we wore it like a badge for a while until we realized that no one really had a concept of what it was like to be Portuguese. But I'm half.
Wow.
Half Portuguese.
Wow, that's incredible.
So do you want to rethink this concept of me being the only white guy on your podcast?
Yeah,
now?
We should just end it. Yeah, I'm going to end this interview, but it was great chatting.
You might have to go off and get Ewan McGregor now to come on and talk to you or somebody like that.
I'm glad you brought this whole like issue of ethnicity and your background, because a friend of mine who has this podcast called Another Round, her name is Tracy Clayton, she assemble like pictures of like you, like Thurgood Marshall and Cab Calloway and like other like light-skinned black dudes from back in the day. She has this thing called Tom Hanks is a Black Man, because she's like, if you compare the pictures, you do kind of look like pass as like a light-skinned black dude. That's wild.
Highest praise imaginable. I'm going to tell my crack staff here at the office to start developing those light-skinned black man stories. that's funny.
Yeah. So yeah.
You know, when I let me tell you a story that when I first moved to New York in like 1977, my hair was really dark, and I went there at the end of the summer, and so I had my summer tan, and I picked up something from a store, and the black guy at the cash register told me how much. I think I was buying a carton of milk for $2. And he looked at me and he said, $2, dos, he said, dos. He said it to me in Spanish, like I was Puerto Rican or Cuban.
Yeah.
I felt like $1 million. I thought, oh, man, I'm in New York and I'm already passing as one of the members of the Sharks from West Side Story. This is fabulous. Dos, he said to me. And when I handed it over, I might have said, gracias, por favor, something like that. I might have spoke back to him in what high school Spanish I had.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's that thick, curly hair.
Yeah, it is the curly hair. That could throw a lot of people off. They're not sure. You could fit in with a lot of groups. So we want to talk about white men for a second. So there is one currently in the White House. And you recently sent the White House press corps an espresso machine. Like, what made you want to do that for them?
It's a longstanding joke. Back when white guys like me got invited to the White House just to come, you know, and visit, I was on a tour of it with my kids. And you go down to the press room, and I went back and I saw their coffee area, and it was this sad little old, like, Mr. Coffee, you know, drip percolator kind of thing. And I said, is this the only coffee you have here? This is, well, yeah, yeah. And I said, no, I'm going to send you a decent coffee machine. So back in the 90s, I sent them a decent coffee machine. And about 10 years later, we were back and we did the same thing. I said, oh, you know what? I'll pony up. I'll give you another decent coffee machine. So he did. And then a million years later, just now in 2017, here at the office, I said, hey, you know, it's probably time to re-up for the White House. Go ahead. Let's order another one, send it along, and I'll include my note. Now, the difference between this coffee machine and those previous coffee machines is two words, social media. Those I gave those coffee machines before Instagram and email and Twitter and what have you. So I got a lot of credit just for making sure that the White House press corps still had a decent source of the legal addictive stimulant that is coffee.
So you've been to the White House a few times. What's your favorite memory from that those experiences?
Well, the first time is always, you hear music when you go there for the first time, you know. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, the most memorable time was we were in Washington, D.C., and it was for the dedication of the World War II Memorial, which, I helped raise money for. And there was a big event out on the mall, and this was when George W. Bush was president. Mm-hmm. And we asked for a tour of the White House because my two younger boys were with me. And we went there, and the place, it was a Saturday or a Sunday, it was the weekend, and so nothing was happening in the White House. It was empty. And my wife, she had to use the restroom. So she went off to the restroom, and we were relatively quickly shunted into this side room because the president himself was going to be coming by on his way to the gym. And I think the thing was, is like, he's not working that day, so he's not glad-handing anybody. He's not meeting anybody. So we just went into a side room and waited for, I guess, him to pass. And as I'm in there, I hear my wife say in the hallway, "Well, hello, Mr. President." And I heard George W. Bush says, "Well, hi, who are you?" And my wife said, "Well, I'm Rita Hanks, Tom's wife." You know, she only busts that out. She busts out the Hanks version of her last name, you know, when convenient. And he said, "Well, of course, how are you?" And so they started talking. He says, "You know, Tom and our boys are here." He says, "Well, where are they?" So we get ushered back out into the main lobby with the president. And there he is. And he's wearing his gym clothes. And he took us outside to the Rose Garden. He was going to show us the Oval Office and the Cabinet Room.
Wow.
But then we're walking towards – this is a highlight. Then we're walking towards the Rose Garden to go into the Oval Office, which we saw, and we saw the Cabinet Room. We had a little bit more chat. It was really great. But I swear to God, there was a dead black bird laying in the grass. And we said, "Oh, my gosh, look at that." He said, "Ah, that's a shame." And he picks up the bird with his bare hands. And he says, "Yeah, we get these all the time in a ranch." And he threw the blackbird into the bushes.
What?
Yeah, he flew the blackbird into the bushes to get out of sight. He says, "You know, the crew will pick that up. The crew will get that." But just the way he said, that's a shame. We get this all the time down at the ranch. And he threw this bird in the bushes. Somebody picked it up. I got to tell you, the Hanks family has been dining out on that story for about 1,000 years now. I mean, since that day. Yeah. There you go. How's that?
That's legendary. I was not expecting that. It has so many twists and turns. That's great. Now, in this story, you mentioned Rita Wilson, of course, and you guys have been married something like 25 years?
29 years on April 30th.
29 years, which is amazing. And my brother has been with his wife almost 20 years, and my parents have been together almost 40 years. And so I see all these long-term relationships, and I want to get married one day and stay married forever. So, like, how do you and Rita do it? Because you're both busy. You both have thriving careers. You have a bunch of kids. Like, do you have date nights? Do you do massages? Like, what is the Tom Hanks secret?
Oh, wow. All right. Man, I wish we had something that was as easy to define as that. I will tell you this. We didn't get married young. We didn't get married till we were both 30. You know, we graduated from high school in the same year. Mm-hmm. So we didn't get married on the fly. We didn't get married, you know, in a fever. We weren't like so enamored with each other that we had some goofy version of what love or togetherness is. Mm-hmm. I will say that right from the get-go, I thought that that there was something crazy great about her. You want to call it, you know, at first sight? I'll say there was without a doubt. I met her and I thought, oh Lord, oh, I just crossed some brand of Rubicon here. There's something cooking here. Now it takes a long time in order to get around to the rest of what goes on in a relationship. But we knew each other for, oh, I guess we met in 84 and we got married in 88. So we got together at the first moment that we could. I had two kids. She had none. She comes from a big Greek family. I got to know all of those people. Look, we learned the secret of happiness with each other a long time ago, and that's always telling the truth. And she makes me laugh harder now than she did in 1986. So there's no secret. You just got to meet the right person. And when the time comes, when you go all in, you go all in.
That's amazing.
I mean, you're lucky. I mean, what, your parents have been married 40 years?
Yeah, my dad was 16 when he met my mom, who was 20.
Holy smoke. First of all, shame on your mom. What was she? What was that about? I'm not even going to ask.
They both worked at a fast food restaurant, and my dad was very smitten with my mom. And my mom was like, "You're 16, like what? Like you? What? I'm not interested in you." And my dad kept pursuing her. Like the first date he asked her out on, I think it was like to the movies. She didn't think it was a date. Like my mom was just very kind of adorably clueless about it. And then like
fabulous. It was always helps. Always helps to be adorably clueless.
Yeah,
I've turned it into a lucrative career, but yes, go on.
And, you know, eventually he stuck, and I remember shortly before my mom's dad passed away, he had a talk with my dad and he gave his blessing. He was like, "You're the best person for her. I want you to marry her." And, you know, I think my dad proposed the first time and my mom said no, I think because like we're too young.
No.
Yeah, she was like, "We're too young.
Cold. Wow.
Yeah. And my dad was like not giving up. He was like, "You're the love of my life." And I think he proposed a second time and she said yes and then got married at City Hall.
Okay, now I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think this story could definitely be a movie because the idea of a 20-year-old woman marrying a 16-year-old guy, let's imagine this is a movie, okay?
Okay.
Was your dad by any chance a light-skinned black man?
Yes.
Well, then I could play your dad. I could. What's his name? What's your dad's name?
My dad's name is Philip.
Philip. Tom Hanks. It is most diverse role to date. I'm playing Philip. Bring it on. I'll bring insight into that drive. We could shoot it motion capture with a lot of CGI so I could play him as a 16-year-old boy, hell-bent. What's your mom's name?
My mom's name is Octavia.
Oh, holy cow, Octavia. Gorgeous.
Yeah, so they've been married ever since, and it's great. So I'm just so fascinated by couples that can make it like my longest relationship is like 4.5 years. And that was like,
that's
boy.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, but after 4.5 years, you know, you know if you're in it for the long haul or if he's in it for the long haul. And sometimes you got to go through that because guess what? The answer is no. Then you don't marry that person and you still got it. You'll have a shot at that other thing you want, which is being married forever. My parents, both of them pioneered the marriage dissolution laws for the state of California. My mom was married 4 times until she found the great, great love of her life.
Wow.
My dad was married 3 times before he found the great, great love of his life. My parents split up the first time when I was five. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like either one of them was getting a divorce, I think, about every 3.5 years of my youth. What I did not have was the version of what you had. With Phil and Octavia, or that my wife had with her folks. Her folks made it well past 50. That to me, that's the outlier there. I don't know how people do that.
Yeah, that's.
And yet they do.
Yeah, it's amazing. I want to switch gears and talk about your career for a little bit, if that's okay with you.
All right.
So I love the actors to actors conversation that you had with Viola Davis on Variety.
Yeah.
It was so great. And you two were talking about acting, and you mentioned that as an actor, like, you deal with imposter syndrome, which to me is shocking because I've grown up with your work. You're so incredibly talented at what you do. I rewatched Castaway the other night and was like sobbing in my apartment to myself. Do you still feel that way now? Like today, you still feel there's a little part of you that's like, I don't know, someone's going to find out I'm a phony. I'm not that great at what I do.
I think it just goes along with the territory. Look, I'm confident in many, many aspects of the profession that I have chosen for myself. I now am not nearly as intimidated in regards to preparing for something or preparing for a role or even judging whether or not it's something that I want to do or not. If I read something and I'm not going to do it, I don't never look back and think, ah, geez, I should have done that job because somebody else went off and made it a great movie and I could have done. I never think that way because it has to land in your instinctive wheelhouse right off the bat. Otherwise, you're going to be faking it. You're going to be pretending to know what you're doing as opposed to actively pursuing the role itself. Now, that's different than actually on the day when you have to show up and you have to make some emotional truth actually occur in a very specific time and place on a very specific day. All these things that come from any movie anybody has did, but speaking for myself, I could sit down with you and we could watch Castaway together and you could pause it at a scene and say, okay, so what about this scene? And I could talk to you about all the fears, all the worries, all the options that we either weighed actually there on the set when we were trying to figure out how we were going to shoot it or inside my own head that led up to what that moment was. Mm-hmm. There's this thing that happens in films where a powerful beat in the story is going to be committed to film, all right? It's like Thursday and this is the day that you are going to say good for the sake of Castaway, say goodbye to Wilson, all right? I never thought about it. I just knew, oh, tomorrow we're going to shoot the scene where I say goodbye to Wilson, where he floats away. Never thought about it. Didn't fret, slept fine, got up, the moment came, went down, went to the place that it was required, and out it came. That is a different professional artistic experience than, say, another part of that movie where I have to wake up on a beach and wonder what's going on. Mm-hmm. That stuff drove me nuts because you don't have an immediate emotional river to jump into, like the scene where you say goodbye to Wilson.
Yeah.
That's just cold water. You jump in, the river takes you downstream, and you're done. The building blocks of what that movie was often required just kind of like tough brand of work in which you test it and you try it, you talk about other different things. And Bob Zemeckis and I, who have a fabulous working relationship, we'd find each other in the course of making a movie like Castaway or the other ones that we'd done. And I'd say, Bob, is anybody going to give a shit about this scene? And Bob would say, you never know. it's a minefield. It's a minefield. I said, but Bob, it's like we're sowing the seeds of our own destruction by even trying to do it. Yeah, isn't it great? That's what movies are. So if the question is like, do I feel confident? I feel confident in approaching the jobs. Mm-hmm. But the jobs themselves end up, whether or not they land, whether or not you're actually capturing the moment that is going to speak to the audience or not, man, that's just a whole other different country that you can't explore. You can't do it unless you have some degree of confidence, but you also cannot do it if that confidence then is encumbered with hubris that says, oh, I know how to do this. Fact is, we don't know how to do it. We just have to prepare and then do it, and we either do it accurately and authentically or not.
I know a handful of actors, and a lot of them are method, and you can just see the toll that their work takes on them spiritually and emotionally. And you seem you know, very warm and mentally sound and light and joyful. And so I'm wondering, like, you've been acting for such a long time. How have you been able to do this job and sort of protect yourself where you don't, you know, in a way that you don't come away damaged, yeah. You know?
Well, the concept of the method actor actually is something I think that we all do at some point, just mm-hmm. not to the most stereotypical version of it. There are moments where we all become our characters. Now, I don't know how to come on. I couldn't walk around on a movie like Sully and say, please call me Sully. And have Sully, would you step into the makeup trailer so we can paint your mustache again? Yes, thank you. You can't do that. It's like we all know what we're doing here. We sleep in hotel rooms in Atlanta. We go to work that day. And there are moments where you have to transcend the falsehood and the silliness of making movies and go there. I mean, that's the best way to describe it, I think, is the moment you come and you just go there. But look, I will say, look, this is going to sound really, you know, golly gee willikers. Mm-hmm. But when I discovered that they did plays in high school, and I thought, I mean, you can do that? You can get up and take a class and get credit for an extracurricular activity for getting up and doing plays, doing shows, well, that's way better than the track team. I've got no interest in being on the yearbook staff or the electronics club. I'll do that. And the excitement of doing it and the hang that goes along with it and the camaraderie as well as the sheer physical excitement and possibilities of being cast in a show is no different then than it is right now. Some people go in it because it's a version of therapy, which it is for me, certainly. Mm-hmm. They want to explore some aspect of the human condition. That's it for me. Some of it is just because, you know, just so enthralled at the idea of standing up and being part of a Shakespeare or a great musical production. It's fun. Look, being an actor is crazy fun. And it has always been fun. For me, you know, I've had my moments at 3 o'clock in the morning somewhere thinking what the hell's happening to me and is this getting out of hand? But I'm 60 years old now. I've been a professional actor. And by that, I mean I've had a union card in my pocket since I was 20 years old.
Wow.
So the I've been able to make my peace with all the business aspects of it, the mm-hmm. highs and lows would go along with that. And also the very personal search for purpose that any actor feels when they're young. And there was a time when I thought I was doing really great and was not. There was other times where I thought that I had absolutely nothing but had been stripped enough of emotionally and kind of self-consciously in order to get to a place that I was surprised that I was able to get to. So look, it's all very much a checkered thing. But, you know, chutzpah and confidence is not nearly as important as I think maybe the opposite of that is, which is a purposeful distancing of yourself from yourself.
Mm.
Being an actor requires a lack of self-consciousness that still requires a degree of self-conscious training, a voice, a character, a look, an idea. You have to get away from that. So that's just is learned over time, but it's a lesson that you start learning from the very first time you get up on stage. You never cease learning it.
That's awesome. I love that. So, you know, the world knows you as this highly accomplished and extremely talented actor, but you have a short story collection coming out this fall called Uncommon Type. Is this your first collection of stories that you've written?
By all means, yeah. I've done writing in a bunch of different circumstances on many series, a few things, and you write oratory, and I've written a number of screenplays, and I've written on screenplays and on things, but I've never sat down and written bona fide prose, mm-hmm. prose stories. But a couple of years ago, I got full of myself and had this idea that I fleshed out. And through a bunch of very circuitous routes and some very, very nice people that kept passing it along to somebody else, it got printed in the New Yorker. And from that, I got an invitation from Random House and Penguin to say, you got any more of these? And I said, well, you know, I sort of do. And so I foolishly said, yeah, and, you know, took on another full-time job. And 2 years later, I had enough of them. So, yeah, the collection will be out in next September, October.
And so each story involves a typewriter. What is why?
Mostly a cheesy device that gives me a reason to you figure out how the typewriter is going to appear in the story first, and then you go on from there. Some of them are just about – there's a reference to a typewriter on a shelf. It's not about typewriters per se. It's about stories in which typewriters appear, and sometimes it's nothing more than a sound coming from another room or something that somebody buys or sees somewhere. It's not about typewriters. It's about about the people that interact with all of this stuff. And the typewriter is just this odd kind of hook.
I like
that.
A little
Easter egg to find inside each one of the stories.
So I want to ask for some advice from you, because I look up to you. You seem to be very on point, and you're hilarious and all these things. And so one of my goals in life is to be the black female Tom Hanks. So what do I got to do?
I hereby dub you the black female Tom Hanks. There
that
you go.
Was
you
so now easy.
Are now you officially are now. Yours is but to ask.
No, but like, take us through your day. Are you like going for a jog in the morning? Like, what are you doing when you're not working in film or writing? Like, what's going on in Hanks's world? Can I call you T. Right. Hanks? Is that okay to call you
T.
Hanks?
Yeah, sure. Listen, this is where you're going to lose listeners, because there's nothing glamorous about this at all. Okay, so Phoebs.
Yes.
I'm 60 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out about 8 years ago that I successfully achieved the status of being a type 2 diabetic.
Oh, no.
Part of it is because of my genes, and part of it is because the horrible lifestyle that I led of eating anything. So now the first thing that I do is I try to take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
I try to get every single day 1 hour of activity, and that could be anything from a treadmill or a walk or a hike with a dog, but it has to be 1 hour every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I watch what I eat to a point of boredom, and every now and again I cheat to the point of self-loathing. That's it. So after that, have some coffee, read the paper, get up, get the workout out of the way, take a shower. Then after that, it's like, come down to the office, see what goes on. Oh, do I got to go to the dentist? Yes, I do. Oh, wait a minute. What are the grandkids? Has Grandparents Day. Off we go to that. Who are we having dinner with tonight? Nobody? Oh, no, let's go see that. And then by that time, is it 8:30? Is it too late to start something on Netflix? I think it's too late. Do you think, should we start something on Netflix? Because we're going to binge whatever it is. Such is my life. I will tell you this. This is a story that I've told to nobody, but I'll tell you, Phoebe, because
Ooh.
You and your dozens of listeners. Actually, this is going to be an interesting test of how wide a net your podcast throws. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So I'm at a thing, like a backstage thing, a show business thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've met him on occasion, but I don't really know him. But I meet, more or less for the second or third time, Jerry Seinfeld.
Cool.
It is cool. He said to me, so what are you up to now? And I said, actually, I just finished a job, and I'm going to take a year off. I had been working a lot for about 6 years, so I'm going to purposely, you know, stay off the clock here for a while. And he says, really? A year off? How does that work? Because he's like a comedian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his whole thing is dates and clubs and, you know, shows. The idea of taking a year off would be anathema to a guy whose job it is to stay fresh and always be working on his material. I said, well, you know, I have to tell you, I'm fatigued. I'm spent. I'm tired. I need to be quiet for a while. I need to rest. So you're tired? I said, yeah, I'm beat. Well, don't you do TM? Now, so transcendental meditation.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So he asked this question. If anybody other than a guy like him had said to me, well, don't you try TM? Like if Goldie Hawn had said, babe, you got to try TM, I would have said, honey, listen, you enjoy your little floral pants and times in the forest, and you commune with the wood sprites all you want. I don't know anything about it. And so I did it. And 2 days later, a great guy came to my house for about four mornings in a row, we spent about an hour. Most of it was just me asking, what isn't transcendental meditation? the end result was, I'm kind of glad I did it now. So now that I have answers to that question, what do you do in your spare time? What else do you do? So I didn't have anything other than wait for a dental appointment, but now I can say, I took up that classic version of transcendental meditation. So there's your answer. That's what I do.
Are you a spiritual person or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I ponder all the great questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because my parents divorced and I lived in so many different circumstances so many times, I went to a lot of different churches when I was growing up, and mm-hmm. my wife is Greek Orthodox, as am I now. My kids have been baptized in the same baptismal font that my wife was baptized in. So yeah, when we go to church, I sit there and I ponder the great philosophical questions.
Aww.
And sometimes not necessarily seeking answers, but just pondering them, you know?
Absolutely. Okay, well, we got to wrap up because I know you're a busy person, but I want to ask you a couple more questions. So this is probably not the most professional thing. Like, Barbara Walters wouldn't do this, but I think this would be very funny. I'm wondering if you could, record the new outgoing message on my voicemail for my phone.
Yeah, sure.
Wait, seriously? That was easy. Okay, great.
Well, you got me right here. I got a microphone and headphones on, so why not? But is it going to be one of those things? Hi, this is Phoebe. I'm not home right now, but if you leave a message at the beep with your name, your number, and the time of day you called, I'll get back to you just as soon as I can. Is that it? Is that the kind of thing you want?
No, you can do whatever you want. You can make it as funny as you want.
You ready? Hello. Hi, this is Tom Hanks. I am a white guy who might have skin dark enough to play her dad, Phil. I hope that's the case. Anyway, that's what Phoebe tells me when she's home. She's not home right now, so you know what to do when the beep goes off. Beep.
Oh, how's my that? God, that was perfect.
Now, but is that kind of like a too long a message to leave? Because if they don't get you, they got to sit through that whole thing. I'm going to give you one other option because this is going down on the dad anyway, right? Okay. Hey, you ready?
Yeah. Okay.
Ready? Great. Hey, Tom Hanks here. Phoebe's not in. Leave a message.
I like having the options. That was good.
All right.
That's great.
All right.
Do you want me to do one for you?
No, because I don't even accept messages on my phone.
Hey guys, it's Tom Hanks. You've heard of me. I won 2 Oscars. Fucking chew on that for a while. I have a hot wife. I go for hikes. I'm incredible. This message that you leave better not be bullshit.
Okay. Now I'm going to have to use that because you made reference to my hot wife. I'm not going to get away with that. By the way, she is.
Come on. Everyone knows
sometimes,
it.
Sometimes I look at that lady in the morning, looking all tussled and all warm from bed and her sweats and her hair piled up on her head. Smoking hot.
Oh, my God, Tom. That is the sweetest thing. That is so sweet. I love that. Thank you so much, Tom. This has really, truly been one of the delights of my life. You're so wonderful, and I really appreciate you sitting down and chatting with me.
I enjoyed it. It was nice talking to you. My best to your folks.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, now I know who's going to play your dad in his biopic.
I mean, Tom Hanks, you guys heard it, says he wants to play my dad in a movie. So Ava DuVernay, let's make this happen. You, me, Tom Hanks, Craft Services, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because it's all set in Cleveland. So, so Tom Hanks can play my dad and then Viola Davis can play my mom. Wouldn't you love to see Tom Hanks and Viola Davis be a married couple in a movie? Wouldn't that be so freaking cute?
Totally. Wait, but Phoebe, who would play you?
Halle Berry.
Oh, yeah. That's hilarious. I love that family. Halle Berry gets a weave. I'm so into it.
Okay, for real, to the listeners, the season is actually over.
Yeah, it's actually over.
That was our last interview. I mean, once you interview Tom Hanks, that's it.
Yeah, there's not going to be a third Token White Guy episode with Michael Rapaport. That's not happening. Let's just keep going.
Okay, let's just start season three right now. Next up, we have Sasha and Malia. Roll the clip, babies.
No, I don't have a clip.
What? Okay. Next up, it's me.
Phoebe, we don't have anything.
Next up, it's me.
We're at the end of the road.
All right. Does this mean I have to do credits?
Yes. We're at the end of the road, Phoebe.
Okay. Time. All right. I'm going to be agreeable and not difficult. Let's do this, babies. For the last time, hold on to your knickers. White Guys team includes Rachel Neal, Jana Solitaroff, Jim Poyant, Paula Schumann, Isaac Jones, Matt Boynton, and Joe Plord. Our theme song was written by a white dude and sung by a bunch of other white dudes. Hey, babies, are you freaking out that we nabbed Tom freaking Hanks? I still am. So go to the WNYC Studios Facebook page to see a totally fresh video of me freaking out minutes after talking to Tom. You're going to think I'm a Meg Ryan level sweetheart. And don't forget, you can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dope Queen Phoebes. Love you, mean it. Thank you guys for listening to season two. We cannot wait for season three. It's going to be even bigger than this season was, which is, that's a high bar to clear, but we're going to try our damnedest. Love you, mean it. YQYE. Bye, Joni.
Bye, Phoebe. Love you.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, that was fun. That was very nice. Jeez, that was thorough.
Yeah. I told story tales out of class. How I've just sown the seeds of my own destruction.